Shalom, Hadavarniks. Welcome to Hadavar Messianic Ministries and our School of Biblical and Jewish Studies. We're studying the prophet Ezekiel, the 2022 edition, and this is session 10. We're beginning in chapter 8 and verse 11. So let's review session 9. Let's review session 9 quickly. In session 9, we saw that a rod of wickedness had blossomed in Judah and Jerusalem. But the flowers of that rod, the fruit of that rod, were not good. They were the fruit of arrogance and the blossom of violence. God then said to the city, you know, blow your wind instrument, perhaps a shofar. And the blowing of the wind instrument was a signal for the army to gather and prepare and defend the city of Jerusalem. And the weapons were all laid out. But the soldiers refused to go away from the city. They were terrified when they saw the Babylonians advance. And therefore God says, well, this is what's going to happen. The people of the city are going to sound like doves. They're going to sound like doves. And he's referring to the mourning dove, not mourning of the day, but mourning the dead. The mourning dove makes sounds. Its normal sound sounds like a person weeping and crying. So they would be mourning over the destruction of life and over the destruction of the city and the temple. Secondly, they would be clothed in sackcloth. A sackcloth is a rough cloth made of animal hair, usually that of a goat or a camel. It's worn to express despair and grief. And it's often used with ashes, pouring ashes on your head, to express despair and grief. Then God said that the Babylonians would profane the temple. They would not only profane and destroy the temple, but he says they will profane my secret room. And his secret room is the Holy of Holies, the cubicle room at the far eastern end of the temple. It was in the Holy of Holies that the Ark of the Covenant was placed. And it was over the Ark of the Covenant that the Shekinah glory, the glory of God, would appear over the mercy seat between the wings of the cherubim, a visible manifestation of God's presence in the Holy of Holies. And it was called the secret room for another reason, and this is because only one man out of the entire world was allowed to enter that room, and only on one day a year, and that was the high priest who offered the Yom Kippur incense offerings and the Yom Kippur blood offerings. But this room would be profaned. Then we moved into chapter 8. In chapter 8, we began by reviewing Ezekiel's time frames. We saw that in chapter 1 through chapter 3 took place in the present. This was Ezekiel's call to prophetic office. And then in chapter 4 to chapter 7, he jumped to the near future, predicting the upcoming destruction of Jerusalem, again in the face of false prophets that refuted his position. And now in chapter 8 through chapter 11, we return to the present time, and the focus here is on why the Shekinah glory has to leave the temple and the city of Jerusalem. Now, when Ezekiel was commissioned, he was given a 430-day commission. He was told to lay on the left side, his left side, for 390 days, and then he was told to lay on his right side for 40 days. These laying on the right and left side proclaimed the days of wickedness in Israel and in Judah. And that is a total of 430 days. 390 plus 40 is a total of 430 days. Now, as we looked at the time indicators in the chapters, we now see that 420 days have elapsed. So there's now 10 days left in his prophetic commission. 10 days left. During those 10 days, he was taken on a journey to Jerusalem, a journey in a vision. Here's Jerusalem on the western side of the Fertile Crescent, and Babylonia is on the eastern side of the Fertile Crescent. And there's the city of Babylon, and just below the city of Babylon, to the south of the city of Babylon, is Ezekiel's Tel Aviv. And so he's transported in a vision from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Now, he finds himself by the gate of the altar. He also states that the Shekinah is there in that area. The divine chariot is in the same area. And again, he affirms that this is the same vision that he had back in chapter 1 of the divine chariot, and especially of the individual sitting on the throne. The individual who from his waist down looks like fire, and from his waist up looks like glowing metal, like electrum. Yes, it's the same vision. He also noted that the image of jealousy was located beside the gate of the altar. Now, the issue there meant that those who were entering the court to offer their sacrifices, going through the gate of the altar, heading for the altar, they had to worship the image of jealousy before they got to the altar and worshiped. And so this is very offensive to God. This was the first kind of idol worship that enraged him. Then he took Ezekiel and showed him the second kind of idol worship. The second kind of idol worship was the worship of Egyptian hieroglyphics, Egyptian gods and goddesses. Now this slide here is a picture of some Egyptian hieroglyphics, and you can see a number of gods and goddesses being portrayed on this wall carving. And so the Jewish people were worshiping Hathor, the mother goddess of Egypt, and they worshiped Thoth, the god of writing and science. And they worshiped Horus, the god of the sky, and the Apis bull. The Apis bull was a major, major god for the Egyptians, and it's thought that it was an Apis bull that was worshiped after the Exodus, and within the idol of the golden calf. And here's the god Amon as a ram. So the Egyptians worshiped 120 different gods and goddesses. And so the Jewish people were getting involved very heavily into this kind of idol worship. Now this brings us to the new material. We've just looked at what the idol worship was that was so offensive to God. Now we're going to look at who the worshipers are. Who were these people worshiping these idols? We start then in chapter 8, verse 11. Standing in front of them were 70 elders of the house of Israel, with Yaazaniah, the son of Shaphan, standing among them, each man with his censer in his hand and the fragrance of the cloud of incense rising. So he now sees 70 elders from the house of Israel. These are lay leaders of Jerusalem. This is a pre-exilic form of the Sanhedrin. And there's a leader. They have a leader, Jaazaniah. Now we're going to run into another Jaazaniah in chapter 11. So they're two different men. This is not the Jaazaniah of chapter 11. The Jaazaniah of chapter 8 is the son of Shaphan. Now Shaphan was a faithful scribe of King Josiah. But this son turned his back on God. In Jeremiah, we learn that Shaphan had three righteous sons. And this is son number 4, who's the black sheep of the family. So let's take a quick look at that. In 2 Kings 22:3, we read, "Now in the 18th year of King Josiah, the king sent Shaphan, the son of Azaliah, the son of Meshulam, the scribe, to the house of the Lord, saying." So here we have Shaphan, a righteous and reliable scribe to King Josiah. Then in Jeremiah 26:24, we read, "The hand of Achikam, the son of Shaphan, was with Jeremiah, so that he was not given into the hands of the people to put him to death." So here another righteous, faithful son is protecting God's prophet Jeremiah. Then we come to Jeremiah 29:3. "The letter was sent by the hand of Elasa, the son of Shaphan, and Gemariah, the son of Hilkiah, whom Zedekiah, king of Judah, sent to Babylon, to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, saying." So here we have another faithful son who's entrusted with this mission for the king. And then in Jeremiah 36:10, "Then Baruch read from the book of the words of Jeremiah in the house of the Lord in the chamber of Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, the scribe, in the upper court at the entry of the new gate of the Lord's house to all the people." So again, here's number 3, son number 3, who's faithful and righteous and reliable. But number 4, Jaazaniah, has broken from the family. Now these elders are secretly worshiping idolatry, and the worship is described. Each man has a censer, and there's incense going up. They are offering incense to these idols. And therefore God makes a declaration in verse 12. "Then he said to me, 'Son of man, do you see what the elders of the house of Israel are committing in the dark? Each man in the room of his carved images? For they say, the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. So there's the question. Do you see this, Son of Man? Do you see this, Ezekiel? Every man in his chamber of imagery. See, they were worshiping in private chambers that each elder had in his home set aside for this kind of worship. Now, this is a vision. And so in the vision, of course, Ezekiel can see 70 different guys in 70 different rooms all doing their private worship. And why do they do it? Well, they claim the Lord doesn't see us. The Lord has left the land. The Lord's gone. He's not here. He can't see us. So we'll get away with it. This won't bother anybody. We can get away with this kind of worship. Well, they are forgetting Psalm 139, which was written some 500 years earlier by David. They had this revelation available to them. Here's what David wrote. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You understand my thought from afar. So distance is no problem for God. He knows what's going on in our hearts, whether he's near or far. And actually, he's always near because he's omnipresent. He's always present, you know. But if you're far from the temple, he still understands your thought. David says that. David goes on. You scrutinize my path and my lying down and are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there's a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. You've enclosed me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. So they should have realized that distance meant nothing. That the Lord doesn't forsake the law. The Lord is not gone. He's present everywhere. But they're seeking a reason, a rationale for worshiping idols. Then we come to a transition in verse 13. And he said to me, yet you will see still greater abominations which they are committing. Ezekiel, if you think this is bad, buddy, you ain't seen nothing yet. And so in chapter 8, verses 14 and 15, we come to the third type of idolatrous worship. The first type was the image of jealousy. The second type is the Egyptian idols. And now we come to the third type, which is the worship of Tammuz in verse 14. Then he brought me to the entrance of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north. So he's brought into the inner court in front of the northern gate of the Lord's house. So here is the Lord's house. Ezekiel is now in the outer court. And so the Lord brings him into the inner court near the gate of the altar. Now, whether he went through the gate or God just brought him through the wall, who knows? But anyway, he's now in the inner court near the gate of the altar. And there he sees the sin in verse 14. And behold, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. Now, Tammuz, this is the only mention of this god in Scripture. This is a form of nature worship. In Sumerian and Babylonian religion, this was the god Dumuzi, the beloved of Ishtar. Ishtar was a female deity, and this is a male deity. In the Akkadian religion, this is Duzu. This is also the Adonis of the Greeks. This is the god of spring vegetation. This is the dying and rising god. The god dies in winter, is mourned, and then rises again in the spring. So this worship is a perversion of the Bible truth of resurrection. It's a perversion of resurrection, as is reincarnation, a perversion of resurrection. And not only were they worshiping Tammuz, but these women were participating in immoral practices during this worship. So there's immorality right here in the temple court. These women are temple prostitutes. So God makes a declaration in verse 15. He said to me, do you see this, Son of Man? I hope we can hear the disgust in God's voice. And then another transition statement. Yet you will see still greater abominations than these. Ezekiel, the worst is yet to come. And so now we come to verse 16 and the final and worst form of idolatry, the worship of the sun. Then he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the entrance to the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, there were about 25 men with their backs to the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east, and they were prostrating themselves eastward toward the sun. Now, he's already in the inner court. We learned that in verse 14. But now he's taken from the northeastern gate and he moves over to the eastern gate, the primary gate to the temple. The temple faced east. So he's on the gate on the east side there. And from this place, he looks west. He looks at the door of the temple of the Lord. And then he sees between the porch and the altar the sin. He sees 25 men, about 25 men standing in that area. Now, they're representing the priesthood, since this is the inner court. They're representing the 24 courses plus the high priest. David, in 1 Chronicles 24, divided the priests into 24 courses. They would serve 2 weeks a year, and they had the leader, the high priest. Now, these men are standing with their backs toward the temple. They're turned away from God. They're facing toward the east. And remember, the temple faced east, so they've turned their backs on God, and they are worshiping the sun. So worshiping the sun toward the east, perhaps they were worshiping the Egyptian sun god Ra. Who knows? But there's the Egyptians worshiped the sun as well. But worshiping the sun, no matter who it was and what religion it was, is forbidden, strictly forbidden in Deuteronomy 4:19. And beware not to lift up your eyes to heaven and see the sun and the moon and the stars and all the host of heaven, and be drawn away and worship them and serve them, those which the Lord your God has allotted to all the people under the whole heaven. So what makes this so bad? What makes this so bad is that these are the priests themselves. They're right in God's own temple. They're supposed to be serving the Lord, and yet they are rejecting him. And so the wrath of God is explained in verse 17. He said to me, "Do you see the Son of Man? Is it too light a thing for the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they committed here, that they have filled the land with violence and provoked me repeatedly? For behold, they are putting the twig to their nose." So God asks a rhetorical question. Is this a light thing for the house of Judah to do? And the answer, of course, is no, no, no way. This is a heavy-duty sin. And then the results of abandoning God are stated here. The land is filled with violence. They've provoked God to anger, and they're putting the twig to their nose. Well, what does that talk about? Well, apparently, putting the twig to their nose or the branch to their nose is an insulting practice. In the Septuagint, this phrase is translated as mockers. They're mockers. Now, apparently, this was a practice of the Magi. These were the Eastern astrologers from Babylon. And it's believed by some to be an obscene rite, and so the worst of all. See, it's an obscene gesture toward God himself. Now, if this was indeed an obscene gesture by the Magi, the Eastern astrologers, they are going to have a radical change in attitude toward the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob due to the ministry of Daniel in Babylon. Daniel will become the chief of the astrologers, the chief of the Magi. And they're going to come to respect the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob so much that a number of them are going to travel to Jerusalem and to the little town of Bethlehem to worship the Messiah when he comes. So there's going to be a big change in these Eastern astrologers. All right, God's wrath is explained, and now the punishment is explained. Therefore, I indeed will deal in wrath. My eye will have no pity, nor will I spare. And though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, yet I will not listen to them. So he's going to deal in wrath. Wrath reveals God's emotion of indignation toward idolatry. And this judgment will be without mercy. Mercy describes God's intolerance of idolatry. He doesn't tolerate it in the slightest. All right, this now brings us to chapter 9. And we come to the man with the inkhorn. As far as the time frames go, we remain in the present time. God is going to explain why the Shekinah glory has to leave the temple and Jerusalem. So chapter 9 begins in verse 1 with a call to executioners. Then he cried out in my hearing with a loud voice, saying, "Draw near, O executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand." So he cries out with a loud voice. This is a very graphic, a very important revelation. and he calls out to those in charge as executioners to draw near. They are to assemble, each with their weapons in their hand. And these are not literal officers. These are not literal men. They are angelic beings who are appointed to carry out God's will for the city. Remember, this is a vision. And then they respond in verse 2. Behold, six men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his shattering weapon in his hand. And among them was a certain man clothed in linen with a writing case at his loins. And they went in and stood beside the bronze altar. So six individuals respond. Again, these are angelic beings in the form of men. They came by the way of the upper gate, which lies to the north. Well, what gate would that be? Here's a view of the temple from the southwest corner. And as we look at the northern edge, we see there is one gate that's probably the most logical gate, the Tadi gate, the sheep gate, located right here. And so they probably came from the north through the sheep gate and headed over toward the altar. Now, why did they come from the north? Well, that's because the direction of the attack by the Babylonians will come. The Babylonians will attack from the north and enter the city from the north. And remember, this is all portraying what's going to happen when Babylon takes the city. So they arrive, each man with his weapon in his hand, but one man stands out. Man number seven. He's unique. He's clothed in linen. He's a leading angel. He's an angel of higher rank. Now, the rabbis say that he is Gabriel, but he is not named in the text. So that is speculation. And he has a writer's inkhorn by his side rather than a weapon. And the inkhorn is a small case of pens and ink and a knife, which are the tools of a scribe. And so they went in and they stood by the brazen altar, the altar of sacrifice, the altar of judgment. So here they come. They come on in and they stand somewhere over in this area here. Six executioners and one scribe. Then comes the command to mark and to destroy in verses 3 through 7. Before the command is given, the Shekinah glory makes a movement. Verse 3. Then the glory of the God of Israel went up from the cherub, from the cherub on which it had been, to the threshold of the temple. And he called to the men clothed in linen at whose loins was the writing case. So the glory of God goes up from the cherub. Now it would be in the Holy of Holies in the temple. So we see the Shekinah glory there glowing in the Holy of Holies. He would appear, the Shekinah glory would appear between the cherubim on the Ark of the Covenant. We learn that from Numbers 7:89. Now when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him, he heard the voice speaking to him from above the mercy seat, which was on the Ark of the Testimony, from between the two cherubim. And so he spoke to him. So again, here's the Ark of the Covenant with the Shekinah glory appearing above the cherubim. And of course, the average person, the average priest can't see that because the secret room, the Holy of Holies, is screened from the holy place with a veil. And so now the Shekinah glory, which is in that secret room, that cubicle room to the far eastern end of Solomon's temple, makes a move. The Shekinah glory moves from the place, his place over the cherubim, and takes his position at the threshold of the door. He's at the door of the temple building. And he's addressed the man dressed in linen. And now in verse 4, he gives a commission to the man dressed in linen. Verse 4, the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, even through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations which are being committed in its midst. So he's to go throughout the entire city and mark the foreheads of certain men. And they are very identifiable because they sigh, they groan, they weep, they cry. These are the faithful remnant, saddened and distraught over the abominations that are being done in the city and in the temple. Now the prophet Jeremiah would have received this mark on his forehead because he was in the city at that time, and he was faithfully prophesying. He was a member of the faithful remnant. So he would have been marked as well. Now, the literal Hebrew here reads, make a tav, make a mark, make a tav. Well, the tav is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And in the ancient Hebrew, it was the mark of a cross. Now, here's a chart of old Hebrew and Samaritan alphabets over time. And we're in a close-up here at the top of this chart. This is Ezekiel's alphabet. And this is our modern alphabet that you see today. So let's back out and let's go to the bottom of the chart where the two columns are. And now we'll zero in on the two columns. And right here we have a modern Tav. That's a modern Tav. That's what we write today. But this is an ancient Tav. This is Ezekiel's Tav right here, the form of a cross. So we've got the modern Tav, not to be confused with Ezekiel's Tav, which is the form of a cross. And we need to bring in the fact that the key in the New Testament Koine Greek scriptures is the first letter of the word Christos or Messiah, and it is also in the form of a cross. Now, this mark is going to show up. This Tav is going to show up. Ezekiel's Tav is going to show up in a number of places in the Bible. First of all, we see it in the consecration of the priests in Exodus 29. Unleavened bread was part of the ceremony, and the unleavened bread was anointed with oil, as we read in Exodus 29:2. And unleavened bread and unleavened cakes mixed with oil and unleavened wafers spread, mashach, anointed with oil, you shall make them of fine wheat flour. And the Sanchino Chumash, a Jewish commentary, makes this comment at page 527. After they had been baked, the wafers were anointed with oil in the shape of the Greek letter ki. Kind of took me aback when I first read that. What is a Greek letter doing in a Jewish Hebrew consecration ceremony? Especially way back in Moses' day. But the rabbis feel that the mark was the mark of a key, like the Greek letter. And the Sanchino Talmud confirms that. The cakes required mingling, and the wafers anointing, and they were, how were they anointed? In the form of key, footnote 21, in the form of a cross, like the Greek letter. So there it is again. And not only that, the high priest was also anointed with oil, in Exodus 29:7, then you shall take the anointing oil and pour it on his head and anoint him. And then the Sanchino Chumash repeats, one drop of oil was put on his head and another under his eyebrows, and with his finger traced the shape of the letter ki, a Greek letter in a Hebrew ceremony. Why that? That's kind of a mystery. Well, let's summarize the information to date. Exodus 29, unleavened bread was anointed with a key, the high priest was anointed with a key, and in Ezekiel 9:4, the faithful remnant was anointed with a key, the ancient Tav. Now, before we get into the New Testament, this will show up in the New Testament as well. But before we get into that, I want to state that the rabbis in Shabbat 55a stated that both the righteous and the unrighteous receive this mark. They say that everyone received the mark, but the mark carried different messages. They say on the righteous, the Tav was for Tichia, you shall live, the statement you shall live, written in ink. But on the unrighteous, they say the Tav stood for Tamut, you will die, written in blood. But the text says it's only written on the faithful remnant. The mark is only on the faithful remnant, and it's there to protect their life. Now, let's move on again. In the New Testament, the key appears in the Greek form of the word Messiah, Christos, anointed one. The mark is for the purpose of protecting the remnant from God's judgment. And we see this in Revelation 7, 2 through 4. And he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants of our God on their foreheads. So this sealing idea is being carried through right into the end of the Brit Hadashah, right on through Revelation. And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 sealed from every tribe and the sons of Israel. How were they sealed? What was the mark? I suggest to you it's going to be a key. 2 Corinthians 1, 21 and 22 carries this idea as well. Now, he who establishes us with you in Christ and anointed us is God, who also sealed us and gave us the Spirit of our heart as a pledge. See, anointed and protected, sealed. In him you also, and then in Ephesians 1, 4, 13 and 14, again the idea comes forward. In him you also, after listening to the message of truth, the good news of your salvation, having also believed, you were sealed in him with the Holy Spirit of promise. And this idea of protecting and sealing, who is given as a pledge of our inheritance with a view to the redemption of God's own possession, to the praise of his glory. So here's that idea being carried through again. Ephesians 4, do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving each other, just as God in Messiah also has forgiven you. So let's summarize all this information again. In Ezekiel's day, the faithful remnant were marked and sealed and protected from death. In our day, we believers, the faithful remnant from among Jew and Gentile, are marked and sealed and protected. In Ezekiel's day, it was physical death. In our day, we're protected from spiritual death. We're saved and given eternal life. But then in the future, during the tribulation period, the faithful remnant, the 144,000, will be marked and sealed and protected again from death, from the Antichrist and his activities. This is the 144,000. So who protects us all? The one who protects us all is the Messiah, Yeshua, the Christos, the one whose title begins with the letter key. One who begins with the letter Q. All right. Well, let's move on now to the commission to the six men. Their first commission is in chapter 9, verses 5 and 6. But to the others, that's the other six men, he said in my hearing, go through the city after him and strike. Do not let your eye have pity. Do not spare. Utterly slay old men, young men, maidens, little children, and women. Do not touch any man on whom is the mark, and you shall start from my sanctuary. So he tells the other six angels to go after, to follow after the scribe dressed in linen, the one who has the inkhorn, and they are to smite without mercy anyone who does not receive the mark. So all members of the population are included. No one escapes. It's the old, the young, the virgin, the little children, the women. The only limitation, don't come near a man upon whom is the mark. And begin in my sanctuary. Begin at the temple where the idolatry was most rampant and most disgusting. And I think Peter must have had this verse in mind when he wrote 1 Peter 4, 17 and 18. For it is time for judgment to begin with the household of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome of those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if it is with difficulty that the righteous is saved, what will become of the godless man and the sinner? So I think Peter was saying, judgment begins at home. We start with ourselves. And that's what Yeshua said in Matthew 7. He said, why do you look at the speck which is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? You hypocrite! First take the log out of your own eye. Judgment begins at home. And then you'll see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eyes. And then Paul follows up in Romans 2, 9 and 10. He says, there will be tribulation and distress for every soul of man who does evil, of the Jew first. Judgment begins in the family, but also of the Greek. But glory and honor and peace to everyone who does good, to the Jew first. Again, now blessing also starts in the family, but also to the Greek. All right, let's keep that in mind, that we are responsible to live for God and to live righteous lives. Well, now the carrying out of the commission is found in verse 6. So they started with the elders who were before the temple. So he starts with these elders that are there before the house. They're standing in the temple, but they're worshiping Egyptian gods in secret. Then comes the second commission in verse 7. And he said to them, defile the temple and fill the courts with the slain. Go out. So defile the temple, the house of God, and the courts are filled with the slain. And he's talking now about the inner court and the outer court. Now here again is the temple from the southwest corner. Ezekiel is standing somewhere in the inner court. So that small raised court immediately on which the temple is sitting is the inner court. And then the outer court is the large platform that Solomon built to level off the top of Mount Moriah so the temple could sit there. And the slain were the means of defilement because a corpse defiles according to the Mosaic law. And they are then commanded to go forth. And so in verse 7, they obey. Thus they went out and struck down the people in the city. Now remember, this is a vision. This is not literal at this time. It anticipates the literal Babylonian slaughter. This is portraying what's going to happen when the Babylonians come into the city. And seeing this, Ezekiel falls down in intercession. And as they were striking the people, and I alone was left, I fell on my face, and I cried out, saying, alas, Lord God, are you destroying the whole remnant of Israel by pouring out your wrath on Jerusalem? He says he was the only one left. He's the only one left of the 70 elders and the 25 priests. You know, that's 95 people. And the women weeping for Tammuz. If there were five women, that's 100 people died in the courts there. He saw 100 people died in this vision. And so he is distraught. He cries out this exclamation of entreaty and appeal. Are you going to destroy all of Jerusalem? You know, he's overwhelmed by the extent and ferocity of this judgment. Now God replies by telling him why he has to be so extensive in the judgment. And the answer begins in verse 9. Then he said to me, the iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah is very, very great. And the land is filled with blood, and the city is full of perversion. For they say, the Lord has forsaken the land. The Lord does not see. So, unfortunately, the iniquity of the house of Israel is exceedingly great. So the extent of evil and cruelty and immorality is exceeding, is terrible, it's tremendous. And so God gets upset over the way we behave. This deals with the way we behave. He gets upset over that. He watches that. And he says the land is full of blood. There's violence everywhere, violence and death everywhere. That's what that term blood stands for. So he gets upset over the way we treat each other. And then the city is full of perversion. It's they're persisting in doing wrong. The people are persisting in acting this way, being cruel and immoral and violent. And why? Well, the evidence for this is their words. The Lord has forsaken the land. The Lord doesn't see. In other words, I'm going to get away with it. God's not going to care. I'll escape the consequences. They're forgetting Psalm 139. They're also misinterpreting the previous judgment as the absence of God. Deportations number 1 and 2. We're coming now to the third deportation. So they say, God's gone. He's left us. That's why Nebuchadnezzar could deport us in deportations 1 and 2. God is not around. He's not going to find out the way I behave and the way I act. And so, because this immorality is so extreme, judgment will be without mercy in verse 10. But as for me, my eye will have no pity, nor will I spare, but I will bring their conduct upon their heads. So the character of the judgment is that it is implacable and relentless. They will reap what they sow. Remember now, this is not revenge. This is justice. This is justice, not revenge. They're getting what they sow. They're getting what they deserve. And now as we come to verse 11, a report comes to the Lord. Then behold, the man clothed in linen, at whose loins was the writing case, reported, saying, I have done just as you have commanded me. So the man clothed in linen brings this report regarding his commission. He's been successful. All those who are not marked with the Tav will die. And remember, this is a vision explaining why God's visible manifestation will depart the temple. This is not literally happening at the moment. It is a vision. It is happening. It's a vision that's happening in Ezekiel's Ezekiel's present time. It's portraying what's going to happen in the near future. Now we come to chapter 10. And we begin to look at the stages of the departure of the Shekinah glory in chapter 10, verse 1 through 11:25. So we begin with the first stage in verses 1 through 8, and chapter 10, verse 1. Then I looked, and behold, in the expanse that was over the heads of the cherubim, something like a sapphire stone in appearance, resembling a throne, appeared above them. Remember, the Shekinah glory, the divine chariot, is there in the area. He mentioned that earlier. And so he looks up and he sees the firmament above the head of the cherubs. And on that firmament is the likeness of a throne. So here's what he's seeing. He's seeing that same vision and he's focusing in on the throne that's up on the divine chariot. Then a commission is given in verse 2. And he spoke to the man clothed in linen and said, enter under the cherubim and fill your hands with the coals of fire from between the cherubim and scatter them all over the city. So the focus is the man in linen. He's to go between the whirling wheels. Now here's the divine chariot and there's the whirling wheels. That's the way they're entitled. And he's to go into the square formed by the four cherubim and fill his hands with coals of fire from the cherubim that was found in the square. And then scatter it all over Jerusalem as a sign of judgment. And then in verse 2, second part of verse 2, he obeys. And he entered in my sight. And so here we have the divine chariot again. And the man in linen then enters into the proper area. In verses 3 through 5, the movement of the Shekinah glory is then explained. We start with the position of the cherubim in verse 3. Now the cherubim were standing on the right side of the temple when the man entered and the cloud filled the inner court. So the cherubim stood on the right side of the house when the man went in. Well, this is their initial position was on the left side. Here is the initial position before we come to these verses. And then the transfer occurs in verse 4. This is a repetition of verse 3. Then the glory of the Lord went up from the cherub to the threshold of the temple. So the glory of the Lord mounted up from the cherub. That's the first position. There he is in the Holy of Holies. This is the first position in the Holy of Holies. And they stood over the threshold of the house. So the Shekinah glory moves to the door of the temple. That's the second position. And apparently at this moment, the divine chariot moves to the right side of Solomon's temple, to the right side. And the results of this movement in verse 4, and the temple was filled with a cloud, and the court was filled with the brightness of the glory of the Lord. So the interior is filled with the glory cloud once the Shekinah glory moves from atop the cherubim. But when the divine chariot moves and changes its position, then the entire court, the entire inner court, is filled with the brightness of God's glory. And there's one more phenomena accompanying this in verse 5. Moreover, the sound of the wings of the cherubim was heard as far as the outer court, like the voice of God Almighty as he speaks. So we already know that when the cherubs move and raise their wings, there's a sound of thunder. There's a sound of rolling thunder. And then the man receives the coals of fire, verse 6. And it came about when he commanded the man clothed in linen, saying, take fire from between the whirling wheels, from between the cherubim. He entered and stood beside a wheel. So again, here we go. He enters and stands beside a wheel. He goes in, into the proper location. And he receives the fire in verse 7. Then the cherub stretched out his hand from between the cherubim to the fire, which was between the cherubim. So he stretches his hand into that square area. And he took some of it and put it into the hands of the one clothed in linen, who took it and went out. So one of the four cherubs, and here they are again, one of the four cherubs reaches into the fire area that's in the middle of those, the cherubim, and he picks up this coal and he hands it to the man who is clothed in linen, and he receives it into his hand, and then he leaves the area. Then the hand is described in verse 8. The cherubim appeared to have the form of a man's hand under their wings. So he's referring to the hand that gave the man the fire. And he goes on in verses 9 through 17 to describe the cherubim again. The same description in chapter 1 that we found in chapter 1. So we begin in verse 9. Then I looked, and behold, four wheels beside the cherubim, and one wheel beside each cherub. So here's our divine chariot again, and there's our four wheels, like so. And the appearance of the wheels is described in verses 9 and 10. And the appearance of the wheels was like the gleam of Tarshish stone. As for their appearance, all four of them had the same likeness, as if one wheel were within another wheel. So the appearance of the wheels was like this beryl that we saw in chapter 1, the stone of Tarshish. This is this bluish aquamarine color. And they all looked alike. They were all identical, as if a wheel had been within a wheel. So he's looking at the wheels, and one wheel is bisecting another wheel. And then their directions are stated in verse 11. When they moved, they went in any of their four directions without turning as they went. But they followed in the direction which they faced without turning as they went. So they could move in four directions, right, left, back, forward, north, south, east, west, however you want to do it. But they didn't turn as they went. They didn't turn. They didn't turn to the right. They didn't turn to the right or left like you have to turn the wheels of your car to the right or left to change direction. And I ran across this picture of a Jeep Hurricane concept car with four-wheel steering. I thought it was a perfect illustration of what did not happen. The cherubim did not have to do anything like this. Their wheels did not change direction in order to didn't have to move in order to cause them to change direction. And now in verse 12, we get some additional information. Their whole body, their backs, their hands, their wings, and the wheels were full of eyes all around, the wheels belonging to all four of them. So this is some additional information. And now everything is included in the description of eyes. The body, the backs, the hands, the wings, the wheels. Earlier, it was only the wheels that were mentioned as being full of eyes. But now the cherubim are full of eyes as well. Now, the significance of the eyes portrays omniscience. The omniscience of God, he's all-knowing. He sees everything. They portray the omnipresence of God. He's all-present. Nothing escapes his gaze. He's always there. He knows everything. So this is new information about the divine chariot. A much more dramatic portrayal of God's omniscience and omnipresence than we had seen earlier. Now, as for the wheels, they were called in my hearing, in verse 13, the whirling wheels. The wheels were called in my hearing the whirling wheels. So this describes the spinning motion of the wheels. So here's all our wheels, and they're all spinning somehow. They whirled around, they rotated, but they didn't turn in a right or left direction. They did spin around, though. Then he describes the cherubim in verse 14. And each one had four faces. The first face was the face of a cherub. The second face was the face of a man. The third was the face of a lion. And the fourth, the face of an eagle. Now, this first face is a different description from chapter 1. Here, it's the face of a cherub. In chapter 1, verse 10, it was the face of an ox. So these faces, the first face, seems to have synonymous terms associated with it. So the new information may mean that the primary feature of a cherub would be that of an ox. That might be their primary face. And as we looked at that earlier in chapter 1, we saw the Gospel of Mark portrayed Yeshua as the obedient servant of the Lord, as an ox is an obedient servant of his master. And then the second face is the face of a man. And we saw in the Gospel of Luke that Yeshua is portrayed as the ideal man. And the third face is the face of a lion. In the Gospel of Matthew, we saw Yeshua was the King Messiah and the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And the fourth face is the face of an eagle, and that would refer to the Gospel of John, where Jesus is the divine Son of God. And so the cherubim proclaim the Messiahship of Yeshua through their faces. And now the actions of the divine chariot. We start with the beginning of the movement. Then the cherubim rose up. They are the living beings that I saw by the river Chebar. So this is the same divine chariot that he saw in chapter 1. Then the movement of the wheels is described in verses 16 and 17. Now, when the cherubim moved, the wheels would go beside them. Also, when the cherubim lifted up their wings to rise from the ground, the wheels would not turn from beside them. When the cherubim stood still, the wheels would stand still. And when they rose up, the wheels would rise up with them. For the Spirit of the living God was in them. And so everything here is a unit. The divine chariot is a very complex unit. And this speaks of God, who is a complex unity of three. Our God is triune. He's a complex unity, just as this divine chariot is. Now we come to the second stage of the Shekinah's departure. The first position was from the door of the temple and to the second position in verse 18. Then the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. Now remember, here we are. The initial position is at the door of the temple. And then the Shekinah glory moves to its position and takes its place on the throne of the divine chariot. Remember the divine chariot and moved over to the right side there. So now we have the Shekinah glory on the throne of the divine chariot. And then the transfer happens in verse 19. When the cherubim departed, they lifted their wings and rose up from the earth in my sight with the wheels beside them. And so the wings begin moving and the wheels move beside them in unity, and I'm sure there was that rumbling sound of thunder as well. And this brings the divine chariot and the Shekinah glory to the third position in verse 19. And they stood still at the entrance of the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the God of Israel hovered over them. So they're going to go to the east gate of the Lord's house. They're standing beside the temple proper here. And now the transfer begins. The divine chariot moves, heading for the eastern gate, out of the inner court to the outer court. Now here we're looking at the temple, again from the southwestern corner of the outer court. And so the Shekinah glory now moves over to the eastern gate. Now this would be the Susa gate in Ezekiel's day. And he hovers over the Susa gate. And then, and as we get into verse 20, the positive identification of the cherubs is made by Ezekiel. These are the living beings that I saw beneath the God of Israel by the river Chebar. So I knew that they were cherubim. Now, he affirms that these are the same living creatures that he saw in chapter 1, but he says they are underneath, they're beneath the God of Israel. Now, who are they referring to? They're referring to here's our cherubs right here, 2, 3, and 4. They're beneath the God of Israel. They're beneath the God of Israel. So the likeness of the man on the throne is God himself. That's God himself on the throne, appearing in a man-like appearance. They're beneath the God of Israel. That is the God of Israel right there in his glory. And he states this was by the river Chebar, because in chapter 1 he said the same thing. And so this is a positive confirmation that these are the same angels that he had viewed previously. And then he gives them a general description in verse 21. Each one had four faces, and each one four wings, and beneath their wings was the form of human hands. So this is exactly the same as chapter 1, same beings that he saw them, the cherubim. And then he describes the faces in verse 22. As for the likeness of their faces, they were the same faces whose appearance I had seen by the river Chebar. Each one went straight ahead. And again, we have this description that's exactly the same as chapter 1. All right, well now this brings us to chapter 11. And I see on my clock here that I've got less than 5 minutes to go. So I don't think it's a good idea to move into chapter 11 at this point. So next session, we'll pick this up at chapter 11 and we'll take a look at the cauldron and the flesh. This scene is going to emphasize once again why the Shekhinah will depart from Jerusalem and depart from the temple. Why does this have to happen? Well, part of the reason is the cauldron and the flesh. All right, I think you'll find chapter 11 to be fascinating, just as these previous chapters were. So we'll see you next session. See you next session. Thanks for being our students. Lahitraot.